Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 336. It's July the 14th, 1978. There are two books coming out that I'm sure most of you listeners will want to get. I'm looking forward to them. I think one is out right now. It's called The Russian Fascist, Tragedy and Farce in Exile, 1925 to 1945. It's written by John J. Stephen, described as the amazing untold story of a Russian emigre movement to take control of the Soviet Union and put it under the swastika. It's published by Harper and Row. Of course, all the red-baiting that's going on in the news now, all over the front page of the headlines, the radio, television, is a constant barrage about those trials going on in the Soviet Union. I know that the Soviet Union is not perfect, but I believe that this is a continuation of fingering them. The government in power, Jimmy Carter, does not go to Brazil or Argentina or Paraguay and talk about the fascism around the world, or the fact that they don't even have trials, that they just murder people right on the streets without trials. I think that this is part of the Cold War, the excuse to break the SALT agreement and to continue the fascists, who eventually do want to put the Russians under the swastika, and the excuse for antagonism is these particular trials. We can't even manage our own trials in the United States, and yet we interfere with their trials, and I think it's just a good chance for Mr. Solzhenitsyn and Brzezinski and the white Russian Tsarist Nazis to continue their propaganda over this particular point. It could be that the selected people were set up, particularly with the Los Angeles Times reporter, knowing that they'd be caught so that they could create this scare and talk about these trials and turn the world against the Soviet Union. I have no sympathy for this anti-Russian talk now, and even the Jews that are leading this and talking about the Jews being persecuted in the Soviet Union, they never mentioned what the Soviet Union did to protect the lives of Jews, and during World War II, the losses that they sustained in stopping Adolf Hitler. I think the Jewish people are foolish to continue this talk and make an issue of it over and over again and not look around the world to where the Nazis are really stationed and what they're doing in terms of human rights all over the world. Another book that will be out in November, it's not out yet, it's called Who Financed Hitler by James Poole and Suzanne Poole. It'll be out in November. It'll be $9.95. I got information of this from a listener who subscribes to the tapes. It was described in Publishers Weekly as a book to look forward to. It says a sensational documented book reveals for the first time where the Nazi Party got its money from 1919 to 1933. You see, that's at the time of the Russian Revolution and the end of the Versailles Treaty, when the war was over, the signing of the Versailles Treaty. Hitler was carefully selected as the front man, and the money men used him as a bulwark against, in quotes, communism. But this was the birth of what we now know as fascism. This book on who financed Hitler goes into the Russian emigre community, and I'm sure there'll be an overlap here to the book The Russian Fascist. It talks about that emigre community in Britain and the United States. This book goes into why the Duke of Windsor abdicated. That was Edward VIII, and it has to do with his strong Nazi connections and his Nazi sympathies. And it also goes into several other people that are important to the assassination work. One, of course, is the American car maker Henry Ford, and the other is Mr. de Terding, who worked with Queen Juliana and Dutch Oil. This is an interesting book, Who Financed Hitler? We'll look for it in November of 1978. The Russian fascists are out now. The Washington Post has an article titled Intelligence Data Declines, the Secret Service Reports. It's the gist of this particular article, dated July 5th, 1978, is that the Secret Service has not enough agents to protect the presidents of the United States and other public figures, and that their work will be seriously impaired, that certain cities are dangerous for Jimmy Carter, and that they've advised him not to go to those cities. They haven't named the cities, but they say they need more agents. This reminds me when John Kennedy was assassinated, how the Secret Service went to the Protective Division where certain persons who are dangerous to the life of the president or threaten him are listed. And Mr. Lawson testified he was there 10 minutes and then left. And that's all the information they gave him was 10 minutes worth before they sent the president of the United States to Dallas. We don't know if this Secret Service report is a warning or a sounding board, but what they're saying is if the president is killed, we didn't have enough people to protect him. So just sit on it, and we'll wait and see if Jimmy Carter does get assassinated up near election time, and then they can come back and say, see, I told you so. We didn't have enough men. There's a name in the news this past week in the San Francisco Chronicle. I don't know how far it'll get north, south, and east, and I want to bring it up to you because it's an important name, and I have mentioned him on earlier shows on Dialogue Conspiracy. That's David R. Toschi, T-O-S-C-H-I. He was working for the Homicide Department in San Francisco. He's been transferred to another department for a while because there were revelations that he was sending information about himself to a man in the newspaper who was writing about him and kind of making him a celebrity because of his investigation of the Zodiac killings in the state of California. David Toschi has also become a suspect that he authored the recent Zodiac letter, which was sent to the San Francisco Chronicle in last April. He acted very indignant about the fact that he could have even be a suspect in writing it, but he admitted that he sent letters to a man named Armistead Maupin, who writes Tales of the City, a column in the San Francisco Chronicle, describing himself and making himself a celebrity by, in quotes, by virtue of his association with the Zodiac. He works under Chief Charles Gaines, and I believe that Charles Gaines should be investigated. He was the chief of police in Oakland at the time of the Huey Newton arrest and the Eldridge Cleaver arrest, the San Quentin Six trials. He's part of the FBI counterintelligence program and the CIA Army Operation Chaos. Chief of Police Gaines left Oakland in the heat of these bloody battles and long trials, these racist trials, and chasing and killing black people in Oakland, political activists, and he disappeared for 2 years. It'd be interesting to do some investigative work on where he was. Then he came back to San Francisco, and then we began the racist zebra killings, and culminating then in the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. This is an operation of counterintelligence, and also I feel closely linked to the Zodiac kidnappings that took place several years ago. Well, Mr. Toschi's been removed from his office. He claimed that the reason he sent these letters about himself to the columnist was that it made his family happy. He said, it didn't do any harm. I sent 3 or 4 notes. It was fun for me, and it made me a hero, and it made my family happy. It was sort of fan mail I wrote to myself, and it was harmless. The point is that the letters weren't harmless, because what we have are superstars making fame over bloody massacres in the United States of America. We have people like Melvin Belli and Leland Jaworski and Mr. Bugliosi, F. Lee Bailey, Percy Forman, that are the showpiece orchestrated attorneys for the Defense Industry Security Command, and they are notorious cover-ups. They never go into the hard evidence of these cases, make the lecture circuit, draw big fees, and seem to be selected for the counterintelligence violence that's taking place in the United States. The last letter of the Zodiac killer that was sent to San Francisco was examined by Sherwood Morrill, a retired documents expert from the State Bureau of Criminal Identification, who said, yes, the letter was the Zodiac killer's. But on the other hand, a new investigation took place by Robert Prouty, who said the letter was not written by the Zodiac, and there were a lot of discrepancies in it, and they even suspected David R. Toschi of writing this last one himself. I called Mr. Toschi in July 19th, 1976. I gave him the name of a man who is a suspect, who's, I've heard his name several times from various people, as being behind the Zodiac killings. He said to me that we've had that name for 5 years, but I asked him, did you clear the name? And he said, no, it's not clear. And I said, if you had it and didn't do anything about it, you are either covering up or you are part of the conspiracy if you haven't cleared this. And he said, no, we didn't clear him. He has never been arrested or cleared. The Zodiac killer had done murders in 1968, one at Mount Hermon near Vallejo, a student, one July the 4th, 1969 at Lake Hermon, a 22-year-old waitress, September 27, 1969 at Lake Berryessa Park near Vallejo, and October the 12th, 1969 in Vallejo, again, another student. All the Zodiac Killer had also done some killings down in Riverside and has spread terror around the state. Now, the reason I think this letter surfaced at this time to the San Francisco Chronicle is that this counterintelligence violence of the Pentagon and the defense and the CIA and FBI is always synchronized with our elections. Evel Younger is running for governor of the state. When he's attorney general or the DA, wherever he raises his position in power, and he is a general in the Army, and he also is retired FBI, and he has direct contacts to Washington, D.C. Wherever he moves, violence precedes the elections. It's that old scare law and order case. I think that these four cab drivers in Oakland are going to be linked to the Zodiac case, and maybe is that if this letter is flushed out and found to be a fraud and Mr. David Tosh is removed, the cab drivers may stop being killed in the Oakland area, just like the strangler in Los Angeles was linked to the police department, and all of a sudden all these strangles stopped when one woman escaped when a man as a police officer was putting a handcuffs on her arm and she had the markings. All of a sudden the Hollywood stranglers stopped. We can go into more of that later. That is California counterintelligence. But I do have a letter that I read to David Tosche. This was in July of 76, 2 years ago. And it was written by a woman living in Woodland Hills, dated November 21st, 1971. And it was sent to Judge Charles Franek, who was handling the murder case of John Frazier, who was charged with killing the Dr. Oda, the dentist, and he's an optician. Dr. Oda, his secretary, wife, and several children up in Santa Cruz. Now, I'm going to leave out the last name of this party, of course, because I have to, but I'm going to read you a letter that was written to Judge Franek, and I got a hold of a copy because it was also sent to the Redwood City Tribune where the trial was taking place. I'll jump and leave out the last names, but I want to tell you what this particular person wrote. The Los Angeles Times of today finally had a story about the trial of and murder of the Otas and their secretary. The prosecutor's name is Peter Chang, and the public defender is James Jackson. You asked if I was certain it was John Frazier, who was with Robert, and this is blank, 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 he mentions his name, who this woman alleges is the Zodiac. They were here in Woodland Hills less than a month prior to those killings. He looked exactly like Frazier, and when they were arrested, except for one thing, he also wears glasses. About the van, it was Robert who was driving it. There was a van that was seen at the edge of a tunnel with two people in the car, and yet John Frazier was the only one tried and charged with the murder. He's up at Folsom now and corresponds with me regularly. And this person said there were two people in the car, and it was Robert who was driving it. And I do not recall something that in the newspaper about that at the time. I have some reason to believe that Robert was driving north just last Thursday. So if you're observant, you will see him snickering in the courtroom, who's in Redwood City, to see how his murders are done and taken care of. He is the man that John Frazier is trying to find at the rear of the courtroom. Does Frazier know about the organization of killers called the International White Guard? Does he fear his wife will be killed if he were to name Robert and his father as being heavy in this honorable organization of killers? Robert's letter was also identified as the Zodiac. Robert was also identified as the Zodiac by his sister 3 days before her death. She had read his first message while partly coded. I never believed that she committed suicide any more than their brother-in-law was shot down. When she said her brother-in-law had been shot down, then she committed suicide. And he mentions these two children had been witnesses the night of the Tate murder. And he goes into the killing of Sharon Tate and the persons in her home. These are the kind of killers that this state has been cultivating and nurturing, this party wrote. It's interesting because even in Mr. Vincent Bugliosi's book on Helter Skelter and the Sharon Tate murders, I believe it's mentioned in his book, a pair of eyeglasses was found on the floor of the house that didn't belong to any of the victims and didn't belong to anyone who came in afterwards and or the people that were charged with the murder. And I've heard stories, and also she writes, this person writes about those eyeglasses and refers to them. It said that this particular man, Robert, is 27. At the time, he's 27. This is written in 1971. Sometimes he lets his beard grow. Within the past 2 years, I have seen him all colors and wig lengths. I know him as Robert and also as a Zodiac. In Los Angeles, he sometimes waits for me on Ventura Boulevard, driving on my way to pick up some children from school. He follows behind and then moves to the side until he's sure I recognized him. Someone must know how smart he is. He writes notes, and it's hard to reach you, Princess. He stays sometimes at Lake Tahoe with his older sister, who's a widow, and belongs to the Sierra Club, which was interested in the misuse of the environment. This Robert, may I say, has the eyes and fingerprints that should be checked. Also, I believe Dr. Oda must have prescribed those glasses that were lost the night of the Tate murder. About a plea of not guilty because of reason of insanity is no defense at all. She's referring to John Fraser. Because of the horror of those murders, they should convict everyone who's brought in before the courts. Now, this is signed by a woman. It was sent to me. It was sent to the Redwood City Tribune and in care of Judge Charles Franek at the time. And so in lieu of the David Toshi demotion, because he was making himself a media freak, you see, during the time of election, sending in his name and enjoying the publicity just on the corpses of these poor people. These district attorneys and prosecuting police chiefs become superstars. They build themselves up, as I say, to authors, and the scare of murder in the suburbs continues, and random, senseless murders are taking place. Along those lines was an article this week in a newspaper by a reporter, Chris Weinstein. I'll have to get the newspaper. I don't have a copy or just a reprint. It was in the Los Angeles Times by Charles Manson. It came out in the Vacaville newspaper Sunday, the Vacaville Reporter. It says, convicted mass murderer Charles Manson said in an interview, I got in trouble for going through changes, for cutting people, for shooting people, not because I wanted to, but because I was forced to. Manson is now 44. He said, you are in prison more than I'm in prison. You've got more rules to live by than I do. I can sit down and relax. Can you? And he talks about his lifestyle, and he seems to be relaxed in the environment that he's living in. And he claims that he was serving a life conviction for masterminding the Los Angeles multiple slayings in 1969, where all these seven people were murdered. But he says, I was forced to do those murders. Now, Manson had swastikas on his forehead. The Manson family are neo-Nazis. They were looking for were to a race war with great relish, a black and white war in the United States. And he could be used with the massive LSD and the mind control. And, of course, I have said many, many times that the Manson family story, the links to the military and counterintelligence and the CIA Operation Chaos have never been broken open, but hopefully maybe they will. We'll continue our rolling obituary. A pilot died this week by the name of Claude Etherly. He's the man who flew the plane over Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. He was buried. He had a very pitiful life. He felt very badly about what happened. He had periods of insanity. He was 24 years old, an Army Air Force major, when he had to take the B-29 over Japan and find the targets and lose those bombs August the 6th, 1945, over Hiroshima. He had to drop a bomb where 200,000 people died in nuclear fire. He was discharged from the Army. He had mental problems after that. Later, he was charged with forgery and burglarizing post offices. I'm sure that he was driven literally insane and in his breakdown put in the mental hospital, and so that his personality was discredited, not for the act that he did that brought on the insanity, but they tried to make him responsible for his own problems. He died this week, and I'm sure it's an untimely, sad death, and he felt really badly about it. We don't know how much these people suffer for doing these terrible deeds, and I certainly hope that the robots in the future won't have any conscience. We have Dr. Delgado and the military spending millions of dollars so that we won't have people suffering like Claude Etherly for what they did. That's why the Army is perfecting these robots, so that we can eliminate the one thing that distinguishes us from animals, and that, or one of the few things, and that's conscience. I received a telephone call this week from a very fine lady who takes the tapes, and I like people to write to me and telephone. You don't have to be bashful if you have any questions. There was something that bothered her in the tape that I did about Adolf Hitler, and that was Adolf Hitler's age. And she brought up the subject that he's quite old. He was born in 1889, that he'd be 88 now, and it seems that he would just be too old to be effectual, and this didn't prove that Hitler was alive or not alive, but what could he do at age 88? That kind of bothered her, and it didn't seem possible he could live that long. And at the time she called, I was just going through my weekly pile of newspapers that I let accumulate during the week, and I had spent 2 or 3 hours in the morning reading them when she called. So I thought, well, I'll just cut out from the obituary page, what age are people dying, and how many old people are around that would have been around when Adolf Hitler was here? And it was really an eye-opener, because I got a good view of history by just reading the obituary page. And the deaths that I'm going to cite for you that I covered were just in a time span of one afternoon and evening this week, reading the newspapers. And I want to share some of these deaths with you, because I think they're really important. And I'm glad that she called so I could pick them up. I'm sure I would have picked up some of them, but not all of them. So the remaining side of this tape and the next tape, I want to talk about longevity and who's dying and what they did and how important they are to the total picture of what's going on. I went to my book of lists, which is always valuable at first, and there was a page there on the 20 achievers and an advanced age. Grandma Moses was painting at 100. Bertrand Russell was active in international peace at age 94. George Bernard Shaw wrote a play, Farfetch'd Fables, at 93. Iman de Valera was the president of Ireland at 91. Adolf Zucker was president, chairman of Paramount Pictures at 91. Pablo Picasso was producing drawings and engravings at age 90. Mary Baker Eddy was directing the Christian Science Church at age 89. Arthur Rubinstein gave one of his greatest recitals at Carnegie Hall at 89. Albert Schweitzer headed a hospital in Africa when he was 88. Pablo Casal had cello concerts when he was 88. And Michelangelo was planning a church, the Santa Maria degli Angeli, when he was 88. And Konrad Adenauer, a co-patriot of Adolf Hitler and a brother-in-law of John J. McCloy, who was in charge of the World Bank and the reconstruction of Germany, Konrad Adenauer was Chancellor of Germany at age 88. So I'll cut off at that age to say that this doesn't prove whether Hitler's alive or not, but people can be very active at that age. Well, just in this one day's reading of the newspapers, I came across these obituaries that I thought were interesting for you. General Kurt Student died of Germany. This is from the New York Times. He died in Germany. And of course, the lead article was, he planned Mussolini's rescue raid. Now, Kurt Student, who was 88, just died this week. He was a German commander credited with developing modern airborne tactics. He died, as I say, in West Germany. He planned for World War II the raids that were ordered by Adolf Hitler to rescue Benito Mussolini, who was in a mountaintop detention home when he was ousted from power. General Student was a career officer. He flew in World War I. In 1923, he was a technical services division head of Germany's illicit air force, training secretly at bases in Russia, where he was working with Reinhard Gehlen in the rearming of Germany. At the outbreak of World War II, he directed the Luftwaffe operations and was the man that seized the Netherlands. He was in charge of breaking Belgium, the General Student operations that broke Belgium in the offensive westward. And he then goes on to say he got from Adolf Hitler the Knight's Cross. He headed the German paratroop divisions. He operated against British, Australian, New Zealand troops and mounted up casualties. he was mentioned inside the Third Reich by Albert Speer. And then Adolf Hitler entrusted him, as I say, to rescue Benito Mussolini. It goes on to say that after the war, he was captured in May 28, 1945. He was taken to a military court by the British and sentenced to 5 years in prison. His sentence was dropped on appeal, and he was never put in prison. In 1949, General Student was one of the men commissioned by the British and American Air Force to establish the West German Air Force, and later he went to England to study with the Royal Air Force and aviation industry. This is a man that was killing in France and Belgium, the Netherlands, American troops, a war criminal who trained as soon as the war was over in 1945 and 1949, was put in charge over in England with the Royal Air Force and the aviation industry. And that's what happens to these particular Nazis. You can see when I talk about the book, The Nazis Went Underground, how he was protected, a pilot of the Luftwaffe, rescuing Mussolini, and then used to form these bombing raids, and then taken to Great Britain in 1949 to continue his work and work with the British Air Force. Now, the New York Times has a long obituary, July 5th, if you want to look it up, on Kurt Student. The Monterey Herald, in contrast here, in our local paper, has a one-inch article that says, General Kurt Student, paratroop strategist, he planned the tactics in World War II in a raid in 1943 that freed Italian director Mussolini. He died at age 88, a hospital spokesman said Sunday. That's our Monterey Herald obituary, one sentence. The Washington Post gives five paragraphs to Kurt Student. The Washington Post doesn't go into the fact that he was then taken to England to train the Royal Air Force. That's why it's so important to read many newspapers to see what isn't covered across the United States.